Welcome to Derm Discussions. How often do you see children in your clinical practice? Have you had to deal with pediatric psoriasis? What about molluscum and warts? Has adolescent acne been a prevalent issue in your clinical care? Regardless of whether you answered yes, no, or sometimes to any of these questions, it goes without saying that pediatric dermatology is an important and essential puzzle piece in this overall picture of dermatology. After all, many of the conditions that affect adults can impact children just the same. As you will see, this is a topic that boasts exciting new therapies on the horizon, as well as the potential for robust, engaging conversation. In this episode of Derm Discussions, Dr. Brad Glick virtually sat down with Dr. Lisa Swanson, a board-certified pediatric dermatologist, to talk about the most pressing dermatological issues affecting children. Drawing from her clinical experience, Dr. Swanson discussed her treatment strategies for conditions such as pediatric psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, and adolescent acne, to name a few. She touched on a range of topics within the vast spectrum of pediatric dermatology, offering insight into her dermatology toolbox and discussing what new therapies are up and coming in the field. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Derm Discussions, the new monthly expert-led dermatology podcast series from HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Brad Glick. I'm a board-certified dermatologist and clinical assistant professor of dermatology at the FIU Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine in Miami, Florida. Today, I am pleased to be virtually alongside Dr. Lisa Swanson to review what's new in pediatric dermatology, specifically what's new in the pediatric dermatology toolbox. A little bit about Dr. Swanson. She is a board-certified dermatologist and pediatric dermatologist. She received her MD degree from Tulane University School of Medicine in New Orleans, her internship at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona, dermatology residency at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and fellowship in pediatric dermatology at the Phoenix Children's Hospital in Arizona. She was in private practice in Colorado for 11 years and served as secretary treasurer for the Colorado Dermatological Society. Dr. Swanson, interestingly enough, recently moved to Boise, Idaho to become the first and only pediatric dermatologist in the entire state of Idaho as part of the ADA West Dermatology in Meridian, Idaho, and is currently on staff at the St. Luke's Health System. So, Lisa, welcome to Derm Discussions. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Brad. Thanks for having me. And I've been making a little joke about my status here in Idaho. You know, first and only pediatric dermatologist in the state of Idaho. I'm basically just like Neil Armstrong. Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon. Lisa Swanson, first peds derm in Idaho. It's the same. It's the same level of historical importance and significance. And, you know, I've been trying to make a play on the one small step for mankind, one major leap for, you know, I've been trying to make a play on that for my pediatric dermatology career, but I haven't been able to completely come up with a final draft.
I'm going to think of that as well myself. That could be a very, very good opening line, particularly right? When we're speaking to the Idaho Dermatology Society. Let's jump right into it. I've got a lot of questions for you. I think as dermatologists, we just don't know enough on a regular basis. We see a lot of children, but I think to get the expertise of a pediatric dermatologist is so helpful. So let's jump in right away and talk about pediatric psoriasis, how it's impacting kids these days. Tell us about, you know, we know in adults there are a lot of comorbidities. Are there comorbidities that we need to be aware of in pediatric psoriasis? And there's been a number of approvals this year, so perhaps you can talk about all of those areas.
Yes. So first of all, the impact of pediatric psoriasis on the kiddos is huge in terms of comorbidities and just impact on their general quality of life. We know that in terms of comorbidities, they have a 2 to 4 times increased chance of obesity, Crohn's disease, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, the whole metabolic syndrome, a dramatically increased risk of all of those things. Plus, they have increased risks of anxiety, depression. The impact of psoriasis on their lives is huge. And it also tends to impact the parents too. There was a great article in the JAD back in 2017 talking about the impact of the parents of pediatric kids with psoriasis. And it's huge. Almost all of them are depressed, anxious, worried about their kiddos, that sort of thing. And thankfully, we've had some major developments. I heard a pediatric dermatologist a few years ago say that the treatment of pediatric psoriasis is about 10 years behind the adults, and that's all changing. And it's due to a lot of the recent approvals, which is so exciting. Stelara was approved down to age 6. Taltz was approved down to age 6. And then Enbrel's been improved down to the age of 4 since 2016. So that really is taking us leaps and bounds into the future.
You know, it's remarkable. It is said that still somewhere around 25% of all dermatologists prescribe biologic therapies. And I would imagine amongst all general dermatologists, and even if we throw in our pediatric dermatologists, the number is still fairly small. One of the nice things that I recognize is that when the FDA will approve a drug down to the age of 6 to treat a pediatric population or down to the age of 4, this is phenomenally exciting to me because when I speak on the matter, I can assure my colleagues that if the FDA is going to approve a drug down to such a low age, it really impacts the discussion about safety. So we can feel a little bit more comfortable because that's where the discomfort comes. Tell us about some of these agents and if you're using them in your practice.
So, and I agree with you 100%, getting the approval down to the age of 4 or 6 or wherever it might be, not only makes it easier for pediatric dermatologists to treat these kids, but I think it gives everybody a better comfort level with the medicine. And that's true for the prescribers. It's also true for patients and their families. You know, if you tell a 70-year-old guy that you're going to put him on a biologic for his psoriasis and this medicine is approved down to the age of 6, that speaks volumes to him too. So I think it's really great for all patients and all comers. My kind of practice when it comes to pediatric psoriasis, when it becomes clear that topicals are just not going to do the trick, is I tend to tell patients and their families about the 3 biologics approved in the pediatric population. So I'll tell them about Enbrel, Stelara, and Taltz, the pros and the cons of all 3. And I'll let them kind of make the final decision. I typically will tell them, hey, I'm the navigator. You're the captain. It's my job to tell you which ways you could go. It's your job to tell me what sounds good to you. And I kind of let them guide the ship, if you will. I think up until Taltz's approval, my favorite biologic to treat pediatric psoriasis was Stelara. I feel that its safety profile is just incredible, and its infrequent dosing to me makes it an ideal choice in kids. So that's probably been the one historically that I've used most often is Stelara.
So I'll share with you, and I concur completely, and also in the adults, we have the SOLAR data that really supports significant safety. For myself, just about, I guess, 2.5 years ago, it could even be longer, I treated my first Stelara patient who I actually just saw this past Thursday. She's been on drug for, I guess, just about 3 years now. And honestly, it's changed her life.
Wow.
And I think that this is so comforting, knowing that we have new agents in the toolbox for, as you say, the kiddos. Mm-hmm. And I think the important thing that you mentioned before, too, is that it's not only important for our 70-year-old who is maybe doubting it. They tell them, well, now it's approved down to the age of 6. But the parents of the child who you're about to recommend an injectable medication, it's the same, it's the other side of the spectrum where, you know, the FDA has approved this agent down to a very low age, and they're not going to approve this in this population unless they feel that it's safe.
Right. Totally. It just builds confidence on the level of the patients, the parents, the prescribers, all the above.
2 things before we move on. You know, we have challenges with access.
Yes.
And we often get asked, I was meeting with some individuals from industry today, and I got asked some questions about what's most important for me about a biologic agent. Is it efficacy? Is it safety? Is it associated psoriatic arthritis, which I want to ask you about in a minute. But, you know, the word access comes up a lot. So in the pediatric dermatology setting, in your experience in prescribing biologic therapies, is it easier to get these biologics because it's young kids and it's, you know, small individuals, or is it more difficult?
I actually have found it to be quite easy. Even before Stelara got the official approval, I never had a patient that I wanted on Stelara that I couldn't get on Stelara. And if they had psoriatic arthritis and I wanted to pursue a different medicine, I really didn't get much pushback from that. Now, I was practicing in Colorado at the time. Maybe that helped. But I think also just the impact of comorbidities and the idea of psoriasis as a systemic disease, of systemic inflammation, I think that has really helped build a case that insurance companies actually understand. And so I really haven't had to pull out the big guns and fight when it comes to psoriasis biologics.
One more thing I want to discuss. You mentioned comorbidities, the importance. So it's equally as important, if not more important, because these kiddos have their whole lives ahead of them, as opposed to the 70-year-old who's suffering, and we want to make them better as well.
Yes.
But thinking about psoriatic arthritis, can you say just a few words about PSA in the pediatric population, how often you see it, and you know, kind of segueing from that to biologic therapy?
Of course. So it's much less common in the pediatric population to see psoriatic arthritis. And the one big clue is nail involvement in kids. So if kids have moderate to severe nail involvement, that's kind of a window to the joints. You should immediately be wondering about psoriatic arthritis. So much so that if I see a kiddo with psoriasis and bad psoriatic nails, even if they have no joint complaints, I'm likely to send them to the rheumatologist for at least a baseline exam because that correlation is so strong. And then if it's true that they have psoriatic arthritis, then I'm likely to choose either Taltz or Humira, which is technically off-label for pediatric psoriasis and pediatric psoriatic arthritis, but still has great psoriatic arthritis data and has been approved for several pediatric indications, just not pediatric psoriasis. So certainly if there's joint involvement, those are the two medicines that jump to the top of my list.
I want to shift gears a little bit to another exciting area that I think that we have challenges in dermatology, mostly general dermatologists, where we really need your help as a pediatric dermatologist. And I'm talking about hemangiomas. Now, obviously, there's many treatments for them, intralesional steroids, laser therapies. Tell us a little bit about the use of systemic therapies like beta blockers and share with us, you know, why we should feel comfortable with that, or should we really send all of these patients just to the pediatric dermatologist?
No, I think you should really feel comfortable with it. There are only 280 pediatric dermatologists in the entire country. There are now 8 states without one. These babies are seeing other dermatology providers, and a lot of these hemangiomas, they need good treatment, and propranolol is awesome and safe and something you should really feel comfortable with. No baby with a bad hemangioma should not be treated in this day and age because just the volume of data we have for propranolol is huge. Hemangiomas are near and dear to my heart. I had 3 of them on my face when I was a baby. And so my mom says I was born to be a pediatric dermatologist. But propranolol is incredibly safe. The dose is 2 mg/kg divided either twice a day or 3 times a day. I typically do twice a day. It's very, very well tolerated. The most important thing is that you tell the parents to always give it with food. That prevents the hypoglycemia, which would be the most feared side effect of propranolol. And I've actually never seen it happen because I just make sure they give it with food. Other side effects like decrease in heart rate and blood pressure have been shown to be about 5 beats per minute heart rate wise, 5 points of blood pressure, never enough to clinically make a difference. I've never had to stop a baby's propranolol at any time for any reason in the past 11 years prescribing it nearly every day. And it just works. It works so well. Do it once and you'll be a believer. I always take before pictures and then at 1 month I take after pictures. And parents will see a difference in the hemangioma within 72 hours of starting the propranolol. It's just really amazing.
So obviously there's a lot of variability, how big the hemangioma is, where it's located in terms of making this judgment. So what are the typical hemangiomas in terms of location, size, and actually even the age group, perhaps the youngest where you're utilizing propranolol and then where you sometimes select other therapies? And I'm throwing a lot at you, but also the question of combination therapies.
Yes. Okay, so the most important thing is that it works the best if you treat in the first year of life, during the growth phase of the hemangioma. Studies show it can still benefit after that, but really you're going to get the most bang for your buck if you treat within the first year of life. Hemangiomas that need to be treated, there are a few. So number one, special sites like eyelid, nose, lip. Number 2, any ulcerating hemangiomas. Number three, any really big hemangiomas. Number four, hemangiomas that are in tough functional locations. So on the forearm, where it's going to rub when they're crawling, on the knee, anything that's going to impair their activities as they're growing in the first few years of life. And then what I like to call mushroom hemangiomas. So when you have the big mushroom hemangioma, even when it involutes, it's not going to go away all the way. You're going to have this stalk and this fibrofatty ball on the surface of it. And so the most we can do to shrink those is going to benefit that child later on. And so those, I think, are the big groupings of hemangiomas that should be treated. And typically you want to treat them during the first 9 to 12 months of life. That's considered the growth phase. And the majority of the growth happens in the first 6 months of life.
Are most of these cases monotherapy, or do you combine them with, for instance, intralesional corticosteroids or even laser therapy?
I typically treat 100% with propranolol. I can't remember the last time I did intralesional steroids or laser. Laser can be effective for an ulcerating hemangioma, but the propranolol is going to work for that anyway. I typically am a propranolol girl through and through. Now, the one caveat is that topical timolol can be used for superficial hemangiomas. So with hemangiomas, there are three general types: superficial strawberry ones, deep ones where it just looks like a blue ball under the surface, and then combined where you have a blue ball and strawberry on the surface. Topical timolol will only work for the superficial strawberry ones. So that's an option for those.
Wonderful. I have a question moving on to a different subject, and that is viral lesions. So molluscum and warts. Sometimes you look out in your waiting room and then you talk to the staff and they said, Dr. Glick, it's about 4:15 in the afternoon. I've got your last patient and they have molluscum contagiosum. And mom said they've been to four dermatologists previously. They have about maybe 40 or 50 molluscum. What do you do?
So what I do, so first of all, I explain what molluscum are. They typically have heard that already. I typically will explain that you don't have to treat them, that eventually they go away, but it can take up to 2 to 3 years. And most of the time, the parents and families that are in my office are there because they want to treat them. And I typically will present four treatment options for molluscum in the office. The first is an over-the-counter natural product called Zymoderm that you apply twice a day. You can get it on Amazon for $26. Interestingly enough, people with atopic dermatitis, all the parents want is something natural, but for molluscum, they never choose it. They want like the big guns to really knock out the molluscum. Just kind of an interesting trend that I've observed. Number two option, I will talk about the use of imiquimod. It's controversial in pediatric dermatology. Some people believe in it, some people don't. I happen to think it works, but I only have them apply it to 2 or 3 or 4 molluscum. I don't have them putting it everywhere because that's when you get a lot of the bad reactions to it. So I say put it on 2 or 3, 4 molluscum and just do it Monday, Wednesday, Friday at bedtime, and we give that 8 weeks. And then the third option is Betelgeuse. Never Betelgeuse an armpit or the diaper area. It seems self-explanatory, but I see so many nightmare cases where the children are traumatized because those areas were treated. If you treat those areas, you are guaranteed to get an angry phone call, which I try to avoid like the plague.
How often do you do curettage?
Virtually never. It would take either, you know, a teenager, an adult, somebody who's highly motivated and doesn't mind the pain. I'm not going to curette a kiddo. That's just not, I'm not into screaming. I'm not into crying. I don't like to hold kids down. And so I don't do much curettage.
It's very challenging in general because you don't, I'm just like you. I really don't want to torment a child. I try everything that I can to use retinoids, imiquimod, topical salicylic acid. Tell me about, before we move into what's new and what's coming, is there anything systemic? I mean, I've tried cimetidine before. Have you done that? And I know we'll maybe talk a little bit about warts as well, but what about that?
Well, and real quick, the fourth option that I present to patients is candida. I do a lot of candida for molluscum.
Oh, wow.
Because the nice thing is you only have to treat one of the spots, and kids actually tolerate it really great. A lot of times the first time they're nervous, but then after that they realize it's not so bad. And it's just 0.3 milliliters into one lesion. You know, I choose a spot that's not very painful, or I let them choose and give them some power in it. And it typically takes 3 to 5 treatments to have them all gone. And you just treat one spot every 3 weeks. In terms of cimetidine, I will occasionally use that for warts. I don't typically use it for molluscum. And it's probably because even for warts, I'm just kind of so-so how much it adds. I will never use cimetidine for warts as a solo therapy, but sometimes if I'm doing other things, I'll say, hey, let's add cimetidine too, you know? Depending on location, it really doesn't hurt. Like if you just treat a molluscum on the arm or the leg or the torso, really very minimal pain, if anything involved. I tell the kids it's gonna feel like a pinch for a second and it's really not bad. Warts can be a little bit ouchier because sometimes they're in ouchier locations like the hands or the feet and things like that. So that can be a little bit of a different story. In terms of where to get it, I might encourage the listeners to maybe reach out to me because you know, I was in practice in Colorado for the past 10 years and I used Candida all the time. And then I moved here to Boise, Idaho, and the practice I joined said that their previous experience with Candida had been kind of scary. They hadn't liked it. They had some bad reactions. And so we looked into the formulation that they had previously been using, and it was far different than the formulation that I had been using. So we purchased the one that I had been using that I feel very comfortable with its safety profile. And so I don't know if you'll include my email address at the end or anything like that, but I don't have the where to purchase it info right in front of me, but I'd be happy to give that to anybody who's interested. Because I do think there are different formulations out there, and I never really realized that until I moved here.
Is there a specific name of the formulation?
No, actually what I did when I moved was I took a picture of the vial from Colorado and I emailed it to the people up here in Idaho and I said, I want this one. And so then they found that one.
I'll have HCP Live find some way to create a communication that is appropriate so that if people want to reach out to you that they can certainly do so. Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about acne. Now, that is a very challenging. Sometimes you hit home runs, and sometimes, you know, I go from room to room to room with acne. I put together a cookbook recipe, and it works great in room one. I go to room two, and I've missed out. I just have not gotten it right. And so why don't we go over, you know, your typical approach to adolescent acne or even precocious acne, and then moving forward, and then what are the new therapies that you're using and you have in your toolbox?
Yeah. So I think my first part of my evaluation with the patient, kind of the new patient coming in for acne, is how bad is it? Where all is it? You know, is it face, chest, and back? Is it just face? And what type of acne is it? Is it comedonal, inflammatory, nodular, a mix? Is there scarring? Those are kind of the three things that I'm really assessing as I talk to and examine the patient. And then kind of like with psoriasis, I like to give people options because not only, you know, I'm not a salesperson. I'm not intending to push any treatment on anybody, but it also gives you a good assessment for how bad the patient thinks it is and how aggressive they want to be. So like, for example, a teenage girl, I would say, hey, we could do topicals. We could do topicals and oral antibiotics for the first couple months. We could do a hormone option like birth control pills or spironolactone, or we've got Accutane. And I'll kind of just lay it all out there and see what comes flying back at me, because some people have very strong feelings about one thing or another. And I find it's a good way to tease it out so I don't waste my time, you know, talking too much about one thing that I think is a good idea, but it becomes clear they don't.
You put pretty much every child, or apropos adolescent, on a retinoid when you're treating acne.
I don't always do that. And I know that's a commonly held policy with dermatologists and pediatric dermatologists, but I hate to say I break from the mold in that. And part of it might be because I personally have never been able to tolerate a retinoid. I keep trying. I know it's good for anti-aging. I keep trying, but I personally have never been able to tolerate it. And then being in practice in Colorado where it's so dang dry, it was really hard to prescribe a retinoid of any certain strength. And so, you know, my personal opinion is that you don't always have to include a retinoid to get things under control. But I know I differ from a lot of people in that.
And one thing I would say in certain populations like skin of color, I think it's actually particularly helpful for post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. So I do have a question related to tetracycline antibiotics. Where's your cutoff? When, you know, when do you start them? What's the youngest age you start a tetracycline?
So I would say it used to be like 12, even though the hard and fast rule was 9 and under. I would say my own kind of practice style was more like 12, made me feel more comfortable with the tetracyclines. When Seysara was approved down to age 9, that made me think a little bit differently and gave me a little bit of a different comfort level with it. And when Seysara got approved, I learned a little bit more about odontogenesis and when the enamel of the tooth is done forming, and that tends to be around the age of 8. So I would say I'm not as hard and fast about age 12 as I used to be because of Seysara and its indication down to 9.
I'm so similar to you. I don't know where it came from, because I know that we're okay, let's say, above age 8. And I agree. Seysara and its approval kind of made us rethink that. But I'm a 12-year-old and up. That's where I pretty much start all tetracyclines. And, you know, after 26 years of practice, you just old habits die hard.
Totally true. Totally true. Yeah.
What's new? You know, what's new? What's either coming? What's, you know, what do we have in the toolbox that's new maybe the last year that you might want to talk about? And then also anything emerging?
So we've got Seysara approved down to age 9. I think the big benefit of Seysara compared to minocycline, doxycycline is just its side effect profile. We're not seeing the same things that we worry about with minocycline and doxycycline with Seysara. We're not seeing the photosensitivity. We're not seeing the vertigo. We're not seeing the esophagitis and all of that kind of stuff. So while I think Seysara is awesome, I think it's mostly awesome for its lack of side effects like the other tetracyclines, not so much because I've seen a huge difference in the efficacy. The other cool thing about Seysara is that it's been studied to have minimal impact on gut flora, which I think is also very timely and very important and something that really sets it apart. We've got Amzeeq, which is a topical minocycline 4% foam designed to be used once a day. It has been hard to get covered. I have been enthusiastic about trying, but it has been hard to get covered where I practice. It is also a pretty bright yellow, and the manufacturers say that it washes out of fabrics, but I've had a couple patients tell me that it didn't. So you really want them to put it on at bedtime, wait an hour before they go to bed, and maybe wear something that they don't care about. We've got two new retinoids, the Acleaf and the Araslo, which are exciting. The Acleaf is a completely new retinoid molecule called triferritin, and then Araslo is a different formulation of tazarotene. And that's exciting. I think the other pretty exciting thing is that the newer acne medicines are getting approved down to age 9 from the get-go, which is very, very important because acne is happening at younger and younger ages. It used to be abnormal to have acne before the age of 9. Now it's only abnormal before the age of 7. And it used to be when all the medicines were approved only down to 12, it was really hard to treat these younger kids to get coverage for them. And then on the horizon, we have clascoterone, which I'm so, so excited about. It's been approved down to the age of 9, but it's not available yet. I heard January or February. And it's a topical anti-androgen, which I'm really excited to use. And there's going to be a new tretinoin BPO combo that I think we're excited about as well.
Phenomenal. So I want to shift gears once again, and I'm trying to get in as much as I can here and pick the brain of this amazing pediatric dermatologist here. Tinea capitis is sometimes really tough to treat, and I just have to throw that out there. You know, probably we have to utilize systemic therapy to get those patients better, but tell us your approach to treating tinea capitis.
Number one, I've been seeing a ton of tinea capitis because a lot of people have taken on new pets and animals during the COVID pandemic, and that's where they're picking it up. So ask about new pets in the family. Often that's the source, especially pet guinea pigs, hamsters, pet rats. Those are a really common source for the tinea capitis. And then you do have to treat it with systemics. My favorite is Griseal fulvin. In general, Griseal fulvin is better for microsporum species. Lamisil is better for trichophyton species. But Griseal fulvin tends to be my first choice. Important to give it always with fatty food to help with the absorption. You don't have to do liver function tests. There have been 2 reports of abnormal liver function tests with Griseal fulvin since it came out in 1950. So that's something that's nice. You can avoid having that talk with parents. And I think most pediatric dermatologists don't do labs for terbinafine either, but you just don't even have to talk about it with Griseal fulvin. And then with Griseo fulvin, typically takes 6 weeks to completely clear it. I always follow up at 3 weeks to assess progress and determine if we need to switch to a different medicine.
I want to jump into atopic dermatitis, and that's a really, really big subject. And in fact, when we bring you back, maybe we even just spend a half an hour just on AD, because it's really part of this last wave, the last few years. We have a biologic therapy, and I want to combine some thoughts and some questions that I have for you in terms of your approach, how you approach barrier restoration. But I want to bring up a subject. Dupilumab is an agent that has now just recently been approved down to the age of 6.
Yeah.
So I want to know what your experience has been with this biologic therapy. In general, you're kind of from outside to inside your approach to treating atopic dermatitis. I want to ask if you've seen side effects, especially in the kiddos, if you've been using this agent, like conjunctivitis, and then finally, what's coming? That was an easy question. There's only like five questions in one.
I can wrap this up really easily. So first of all, my experience with Dupixent has been awesome and life-changing. I tell patients and their families, this is a life changer for the patient, their family, and their doctor. It makes me feel better to be able to help these kids in this way. And I've become a little bit known for saying that picking a systemic agent to treat bad atopic dermatitis before we had Dupixent was like picking a porta potty out of a row of porta potties. You know they're all gonna suck, but you gotta pick one when you have to go. I was never excited to put a patient on methotrexate or cyclosporin. I did it out of desperation because I had no idea how else to help them. And so now we don't have to pick porta potties anymore. My experience has been good. A couple of modifications that I make in the pediatric population. I don't do the 2 shots of the loading dose. I think that's just really hard on the kiddos. And I don't think I'm sacrificing efficacy or speed of improvement or anything like that. So I just do 1 shot every time. And then the second thing I do is I don't always follow the FDA approved dosages to a T, because the 300 milligram dose is 2 milliliters of pretty viscous fluid. And the 200 milligram dose is 1.14 milliliters. So you get 2/3 of the dose for almost half the volume. And sometimes that's more tolerable for these kids. In terms of side effects, I've had 2 or 3 patients get conjunctivitis. The points that I make when I'm speaking or when I'm talking to families is that it doesn't hurt, it doesn't itch, it doesn't cause vision problems, it comes and it goes, it's not there all the time. And I've sent the 2 or 3 patients I've had to an ophthalmologist who's given them some drops to treat it, and they're happy as clams. I can say I've had 2 teenagers with it and 1 adult patient with it. So I don't really think it's more prominent or more risky in the younger kids.
And I think in the trials, one of the things we learned is that we have patients that have atopic diatheses, and they come into the trials, at least based on the data that we've learned, both in the 6 to 11 year age, the 12 and above, et cetera, that they come in with the comorbid allergoconjunctivitis, if you will.
Totally. I think it's easy to manage. I often will say, I think it's pretty cool that we have the first ever biologic to treat atopic dermatitis. It works pretty darn well. And the biggest side effect we're all talking about is a red or pink eye. I think that's pretty cool.
So I had the opportunity to treat a then 6-year-old. Now it's pretty much 3 years ago before approval. I'll share this because I actually looked at the Mork data. I actually reached out to Rob Sidbury about this, and I went ahead and I just treated this patient. No one could help her. She was out of school for 6 months. And it's so true what you said, that I can honestly say to you that this is one of my most rewarding cases in my practice. We turned her around within a couple of months. She went back to school within several months. She's grown, she's tall, she sleeps at night. It is remarkable. And I don't think sometimes we even understand how remarkable it is to have an agent, and then hopefully newer agents coming soon for treating AD. And I want to ask you, what's new, what's emerging? I know we mainly have dupilumab, but what's coming?
Yeah. So a couple quick things. First of all, the impact on patients, I think sometimes they don't even realize the impact the AD is having on their life until they go on a medicine like Dupixent. And they're like, how on earth did I live that way before? Second of all, with growth and itch. So there was a study in the JAD maybe a year ago that kids with atopic dermatitis, they don't sleep as well. They don't enter REM as much or as often. And it's during REM sleep that growth hormone is secreted. And so physiologically, these kids are getting less growth hormone, and that's why they're always so teeny. And I've seen them just shoot up with good therapy like dupilumab. So very exciting stuff. In terms of what's new, a lot of stuff. Like, I think the past 10 to 15 years have been the age of psoriasis, and the next 10 to 15 are going to be the age of atopic dermatitis. And we're going to be like Oprah, you get a new therapy, because there's stuff coming down the pipe in topical formulations, like topical tapinarof. There are the topical JAKs that are coming. And then there are the oral JAK inhibitors. There are the IL-13 blockers. It's really an exciting time to be a dermatologist managing inflammatory skin disease, because our toolbox just keeps getting bigger.
Well, as we wind down, I want to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a really pertinent one. So we've heard a lot about dermatologic manifestations of COVID-19.
Yes.
And one of the things I don't think we hear a lot about, and I'm sure it's been talked about, but I'd love for you to have some floor as we close here to tell us about what you've seen in the pediatric population as it relates to manifestations of COVID-19 and how you've handled this, especially during the pandemic, and now that you've actually made a move from one location to another.
Yes. So number one most common thing I saw was COVID toes, and that was back predominantly in March and April. And there's still some controversy about it, because most of these kids had negative PCRs when their nose was swabbed. But I think it's hard to dispute that there's an association. We saw it with such incredible incidence when the pandemic was just first starting. There was a great study out of Italy where they took 26 teenagers with COVID toes. They biopsied 8 of them. All 8 had positive staining for the spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. And one of them was processed for electron microscopy, and you could see the COVID-19 ball with spikes on it in the endothelial cells of the blood vessels. So I think even though their tests are negative, there's a true correlation here. The big take home is these kids and teenagers and 20-somethings who develop COVID toes are fine. They're healthy. They don't have the big serious manifestations of COVID-19. They just have the COVID toes. I've seen 3 patients with a lividoreticularis or lividorasimosa type pattern. All 3 have been hospitalized. So this is a manifestation, a skin manifestation that is occurring in kids with bad COVID-19. And one of them was the kiddo with the multi-system inflammatory disorder that kind of resembles Kawasaki's. And then I've seen 1 patient with erythema multiforme that I sent for a COVID test, and it was positive. And so I've seen 1 erythema multiforme due to COVID. I have not seen the variceliform exanthem that's been described. I have not seen that in any of my patients, but I'm on the lookout for it.
At the beginning of the pandemic, I had a little cluster of cases myself. Very interesting. Send some of them up to the registry. Of course, the Academy has a wonderful registry, and there are registries all around the world. What I found unique is a number of these patients present with a variety of skin manifestations simultaneously. My case, the patient had erythema multiforme-like presentation with concurrent papules of what I felt was almost a pityriasis rosea-like presentation. And those papular presentations have been reported, particularly in Europe, both in Spain and Italy. And I just find the whole COVID-19 has just been totally fascinating and just a remarkable series of unique presentations. And I read recently that the COVID toes have kind of gone back and forth, that some patients that develop them, they linger. It may be for several days. First saw it as long as maybe 30, 45 days, 60 days, and now perhaps even long and outward as much as 120 days or more.
I think the COVID toes do persist for quite some time. I would say weeks to maybe even a couple months. But no treatment. I just told them to keep warm.
One final comment question. So your patient with multi-system inflammatory disease, how did they fare?
So interestingly enough, it was an 8-week-old baby whose mom is a labor and delivery nurse and never knew she had COVID, but likely was exposed. And then poor little baby got it and had multi-system inflammatory. Baby did fine, was discharged from the hospital, never had to be intubated, but was febrile pretty much the whole time, had several echocardiograms just to keep an eye on the heart, but overall did okay. But yeah, that was very interesting to me because the exposure must have happened either in utero or very soon after birth for it to trigger this in an 8-week-old baby. So that was very interesting to me.
Well, listen, Dr. Swanson, Lisa, I just want to thank you so much. This has been incredibly engaging. I feel like in the last 45 minutes or so, I personally have learned so much. I'm sure that our audience is going to learn a tremendous amount. I want to ask you, please, we want to bring you back at some point, so we'll come up with some unique topics to ask you moving forward. Thank you for being the second of our physicians to present in a podcast for Derm Discussions for HCP Live. And with that, I want to say so long and thank you for your involvement and everyone for their attention.
Thanks, Brad.
Have a great night.
Thank you, Dr. Swanson, for your time and insight. Stay tuned for our next Derm Discussion with Dr. Brad Glick. In the meantime, check us out at hcplive.com for more up-to-date clinical news. And be sure to follow us on all our social media channels on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Until next time.